This is JS Party, your weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. The software world moves fast. Keep up the easy way with Changelog News, the only software newsletter that's also a podcast. Sign up today at changelog.com/news. Big thanks to our partners at Fly. Launch your app as close to your users as possible. Fly makes it easy. Learn how at fly.io. Okay, it's party time, y'all.
What's up, friends? I want to share an awesome new announcement from our friends over at Crab Nebula. Crab Nebula is the official partner of Towery. For the uninitiated, Towery is a toolkit that helps developers make applications for the major desktop platforms using virtually any front-end framework in existence. The core is built with Rust, and the CLI leverages Node.js, making Towery a genuinely polyglot approach to creating and maintaining great apps. So building applications with Towery has always been an incredibly joyful experience. However, once the applications are built, distributing them and rolling out updates has always been cumbersome. This is why we are thrilled to be part of this announcement from our friends at Crab Nebula on their latest product, Crab Nebula Cloud. The problem really is the cost of distributing applications, the security, and the feedback and analytics. Just thinking about cost alone to distribute new applications at scale, it can get very expensive when bundle sizes compound with the number of users, which further compounds with frequency of application updates. Always be shipping, right? A 500 meg application distributed across 500 users with nightly updates leads to a total of around 7.5 million megabytes. That's 7.5 terabytes transferred in a single month. Now, based on popular cloud pricing, this could easily lead to a bill in the ballpark of around $90,000. That's a lot of dollars. More so, distributing updates requires complex cryptography to ensure that an update is the original safe artifact for users to download, install, and execute. And then collecting meaningful analytics is more challenging with desktop applications compared to web-based services, impacting the ability to make informed updates and improvements. So at the heart of Crab Nebula Cloud is a purpose-built CDN ready for global scale, ensuring seamless integration with any CI/CD pipeline and first-class support for GitHub Actions. And security updates are a first-class citizen. Leveraging the power of Towery Updater, Crab Nebula Cloud provides an out-of-the-box update server that any application can call to check for signed updates and, if the update is available, immediately download and apply it in an instant over the air. And of course, Towery is open source, and Crab Nebula is a company born out of open source, and they're giving back to the open source community by giving steep discounts and subsidies to open source projects built with Towery. To learn more, get started, and check out the docs, go to crabnebula.dev/cloud. That's crab, C-R-A-B, nebula, N-E-B-U-L-A.dev/cloud. Once again, crabnebula.dev/cloud.
Hello, JS Party people, and welcome to another week of your favorite, my favorite podcast about JavaScript and all things web. I'm K-Ball. I'm your host this week. Joining me today is one of our newest panelists, Jessica Socks. Jessica?
Hello.
Excited to have you. I don't know that we've been on a show since you became an official panelist, though we did have one together back a while ago, I think. Jessica did the organizing for this. She set us up with two amazing guests to talk about some of the hot news in the ecosystem today. I'm joined today by Minko Geshev from, I believe, the Angular team. Is that right?
Yeah, working on Angular as well, together with plus also the Zephyr that we'll be talking about today.
Yes, Angular and Wiz. And then we have Jatin Ramanathan.
Hello. Yeah, nice to be here.
Let's start with the two of you maybe introducing yourselves a little bit, your background, and how you got into this place that you are today, engaging in the merger of Wiz and Angular. Minko, you want to go first?
All right, sure. So currently I work on Angular at Google, where I lead, the product roadmap and developer relations. Previously, I was working on a startup that Coursera acquired back in 2018. And actually, back there, I was not using Angular at all. we built the entire front end in React, but I kept contributing to Angular in my spare time because it was my passion project. So I get to do that full time now.
Awesome. And Jatin?
Yeah. So I joined Google about 12 years ago now. And initially I was on a product team. I was actually working on Google Plus, and we started using Wiz. And it was pretty exciting, very, very new, different way of building websites for me at the time. Over the years, Wiz grew in popularity. A lot of large products at Google, like Search, started using Wiz. However, there were a few products that kind of had picked different stacks. And one of the big ones was YouTube. They had picked a different stack because they weren't doing server-side rendering, and some of the core value propositions of Wiz, like resumability, are like less appealing if you're not doing server-side rendering. And so like the requirements kind of started changing for Wiz. And what we realized was applications that are wanting to use Wiz because it serves, like, it's a proven, like, scalable product, are now kind of looking a little bit like Angular applications. And then similarly, like, you know, Angular applications, teams that are using Angular started asking for features that, you know, have more to do with SSR and so on. And that kind of brought us to this point here where we're trying to merge the two frameworks instead of just trying to, like, compete and see, like, who can do everything better separately.
While many of the people on the show are familiar with Angular, or should be, since it's been around a while in the public eye, we've had a couple interviews recently with folks from the Angular team. When this news came out about Wiz, I think probably everyone else out in the world who is not at Google was kind of like, wait a minute, what is Wiz? So can you maybe give us a little bit more of, like, TLDR, what is Wiz? And then we can dive into some of the key points.
Yeah, sure. So Wiz is a web framework which kind of organically evolved from building blocks that already existed at Google about 10 years ago. If you turn back time 10 years ago and try to remember what Google was doing, it was all about social. Facebook had just completely taken off, and Google was kind of, you know, realizing that they don't really have a great social play. YouTube was kind of doing well, but, like, you know, back then YouTube accounts were completely different, and, like, there was really nothing that Google was kind of getting in terms of social graph. So G+ was one of the largest projects that I've actually ever seen at Google in terms of, like, a web front end. Mobile had started taking off around 2008, but, like, working on the website, like, all features typically started on the web. So very rapidly, G+ was growing in size to become, you know, the largest website ever. And there was a lot of need to break it down systematically into, like, smaller modules so that you're not loading all of the JavaScript just to render, like, the home screen or something. And so this framework, Wiz, started coming into existence from this idea that if you depend on developers to systematically keep chunking the code or code splitting, they're eventually going to get it wrong because either they forget to do it or they make suboptimal decisions. And so what we need is a framework that, like, systematically chunks the code and then has a system to load only the code that's required, depending on what is rendered on the page.
So Wiz is a front-end framework that was born out of the need to performantly chunk front-end code. That's correct, right?
Yeah, this is one of those foundational kind of inspirations for Wiz. It's maybe, like, a couple more, but, like, this is pretty key.
And that was because of the just sheer size of Google Plus. Is that about right?
That's
right. All right, cool.
And other products at Google, like Search, right, have a similar kind of problem. Like 10 years ago, Search had started adding more and more widgets. Like, typically in Search, like, the most interactive thing was the doodle, right? Like, every day it changes and, like, you know, you can play around with it and so on. And then on the results page, it was still, like, you know, a few add links and 10 blue links. But now if you go to Search, you can't recognize it. It's just, like, interactive widgets all over the place. Depending on the query, you get, like, you know, a little, like...
You mean, like, flights and stuff and, like, calculator, all those things?
Yes, those little widgets that show up depending on your search. You search for a restaurant, you can see, like, you know, information about it and so on.
Do you call them widgets internally?
There's a lot of different names for them. I'm just using widget here because cards also, we sometimes call them different kinds.
Naming, the hardest problem in computer science.
I just like to know the internals. I hear that there are a lot of Wizard of Oz jokes because it's called Wiz. I know that's, like, not technical, but I still like the lore. speaking of lore, I'm trying to build the timeline. So when was Wiz created?
I would say around 2014. Yeah.
Okay, so Angular came first and Wiz came second.
Yeah, and for different goals also. They were targeting different use cases, I guess. Angular wanted to remove the boilerplate and create a very expressive framework for building web apps so that it can make developers productive.
Where was Angular used at first? Like, was Search first built in Angular and then cut over to Wiz? Or what was the migration path between like what was there before?
There were some other technologies actually that I'm not familiar with. That was like back in 2010 or so. I think one of the first projects that Angular rebuilt was Google Feedback. And I think they reduced the number of source code lines with something crazy, like 90% or so, after they rewrote it in AngularJS. And Angular existed in a different organization as well. So I guess that's a big difference compared to how the different frameworks team were operating back then and how we operate right now. We were in different, associated with different products. And currently we're in an infrastructure team where we can work closely together and talk to each other easier. Angular was within Google Ads, which is a good position to be in also, because this is one of the biggest revenue streams for the company.
So some of the things you were talking about with regards to Wiz made me think about another framework we've had conversations about on the show. So you were talking about sort of the desire to do chunking automatically, to have, you know, and contrasting to many of the web frameworks out there where you have to work hard to keep it performant, wanting that performance by default. You also mentioned the word resumability. Both of those brought me back to conversations with Mishko Heveri about Qwik. And I'm, before we even get into the like technical pieces, I'm really curious to Jess's point about the lineage here, because he was involved with Angular. He was clearly inside Google. Qwik came after he'd left there, but was he involved with Wiz at all? Like, are these concepts and lineage coming together there, or are these independent attempts at the same problem?
Yeah, so I actually met Mishko recently and learned what I'm about to share here. So this is not the first time Wiz and Angular are trying to merge. It was kind of known that about maybe 2019, when the teams actually kind of organizationally moved really close to each other, and you know, desire was expressed that we're going to try to merge them. And Mishko studied Wiz very, very deeply at that point to try to understand if like the two frameworks can merge. And he kind of concluded that, like, you know, at that point, the frameworks were very different and likely very hard to converge, or like the ROI of converging was not clear to him. And he shared with me that that was the inception of Qwik. Like, when he was writing those papers to try to like understand Wiz and talk about convergence, that's when like the seeds of Qwik were like sown in his mind.
So where I met Jatin and Minko was actually about a month ago at JS Dev. What is it, Dev World, or what was the conference name? I'm gonna mess it up.
Yeah, Dev World.
Dev World. Thank you. Yeah, that's where I met Jatin and Minko, and we spent a lot of time with Shai and Mishko from Qwik, and resumability was a huge topic. One of the first times it actually clicked for me was talking with Jatin, thinking about actually Jatin, your talk was the first time that resumability clicked for me. Is that recorded anywhere?
I think I got an email today that they're going to share it out. But you have to like log into the Dev World site or something. I'm not sure.
Well, you've teased me now. I mean, resumability is such a fun and fascinating topic. I would love to hear the Jatin explanation.
So I have a somewhat different take than Mishko maybe. Like, first of all, I'm like really glad that Mishko and Qwik have given us the vocabulary to talk about stuff like this. Because before the word resumability, I would like struggle to even explain what's going on. And like my hands are waving around and I'm like trying to explain how the event handlers are attached. And like, yeah, but just failing horribly, right? Like everyone's like, you know, I don't understand. Why does it matter? And it's true. It doesn't matter for many, many applications, because you can just have your users wait a second. Right? Maybe they're going to spend a lot of time on your site, like an hour or something. And so like, if it takes another second for it to hydrate, like, what's the problem? But every once in a while, we'll have this experience on the internet where like rage clicking a button and nothing's happening. Like, you got to the site, you could see the button you're clicking and nothing's happening. Why isn't it working? And then, oh, they're loading the JavaScript and hydrating the page. There's no event handler. That's why nothing's happening. So the simplest kind of way to understand resumability would be it's fine. Keep doing hydration like your framework is doing right now. But think about what you can do to not drop events after server-side rendered content is visible and you're about to hydrate the page. And just try to understand what would you need to do if you had this desire, this goal, that you shouldn't drop any events at all. And pulling on that thread kind of starts taking you closer and closer towards resumability. Even if you're thinking you're just going to do hydration, like, you know, React or Vue or any framework today that does hydration, right? You could try to add resumability by trying to save those events.
This reminds me of a pattern that actually I might have first seen in Google Analytics. So I'm wondering the threads here together, where you know, you're loading some third-party JavaScript that is capturing events. And before it's loaded, you're pushing events onto an array.
Is that the TL? Is that the really basic TLDR?
I think this is the way to start thinking about it. What you realize quickly afterwards is the amount of time you have to capture those events and you cannot replay them yet depends on how much JavaScript you load. And then you're like, okay, I need to load the minimum amount of JavaScript, which then means I need to load the event handlers, only load the event handlers that I'm actually about to attach on the page. I don't want to load any event handler that's not yet on the page. So you need to know what was rendered on the page. And then you start trying to optimize that. And then you get a fully resumable kind of framework.
Minko, you looked like you were about to jump in on something.
I was just agreeing with Jaren, actually. And I was thinking that what he is describing right now is kind of the path Angular is taking to an extent, because he can also start loading this code on different levels of granularity and hydrating the entire application and replaying the events would be the least granular one. From there, you can have some partial hydration where you're not loading anything, let's say. And over time, you download only the components that the user is interacting with, but also their parent components, because they might be passing some data to the children. And from there, you can do more optimizations for more fine-grained hydration and reach resumability.
So when people are trying to make sense of what Wiz and Angular merging means, it's basically the concepts that Wiz uses, right? Coming into Angular, but not the DX. Is that about right?
And vice versa. And concepts that Angular has coming to Wiz. Like, good example is what Jaren started explaining at first during his introduction around how we discovered that YouTube has similar requirements to what Angular is building, and with reusing Angular's reactivity was able to deliver on these requirements. Now we're doing something similar the other way around with resumability and fine-grained code loading. So we can dig probably deeper into these two topics at a certain point.
What's up, friends and party people? I'm talking to you today about our friends over at Clerk, the complete suite of embeddable UIs, the full-on, most comprehensive user management platform. If you're using React or Next.js, Clerk is perfect for you. Embeddable UIs, flexible APIs, and admin dashboards to authenticate and manage your users. And I'm here with Clerk CEO Colin Sidoti. Colin, give me the backstory. Why does Clerk exist?
When we started Clerk, we were definitely frustrated that a lot of the authentication solutions, both services or open source, kind of didn't have a good UI built in. And we would look at Google's sign-in experience and Google's user profile, and it just had this like degree of polish and professionalism to it. It just didn't come out of the box with everything else. Usually you start with just email, password as the sign-in options, and then you kind of have to add in extra modules to get OAuth on, and you know, in the user profile, having a profile picture and setting up 2FA, right? It's like all this extra work that you have to do. And with Clerk, I think we really were inspired by Stripe checkout, where here's a checkout and it's great, right? Like, and we had this question of why didn't that exist for auth really? And so for Clerk, you drop in our components and it's really just a complete like end-to-end experience right out of the box with that high degree of polish, high degree of professionalism that I think users have really come to expect these days.
Okay, so easy to drop in components. Really beautiful UI, by the way. I love it. Very nice. Clerk must be the most welcomed easy button when it comes to authentication, good UI, and all that, right?
One of the most striking things, you know, still to this day, I think Clerk might be the only auth solution that comes with a user profile screen. And it's so insane to think about because you need the user profile screen because that's where the user goes and they self-serve to set up 2FA and it ties back into the sign-in. And so it's like we had to do that to be able to offer that experience. But it's so bizarre to us. Auth depends so much on user profile, yet most auth solutions don't include it. And it's just this weird, bizarre thing that never made sense to us. And so approaching it from first principles, we have it out of the box.
Very cool. So pixel perfect UIs embedded in minutes, React or Next.js. This is the easy button for you. Clerk is perfect for you. It is a full-on comprehensive user management platform with, as I said, beautiful UI. Best of all, they have pricing that scales with you. They have a phenomenal free tier, 10,000 monthly active users for free. Plus, when you scale to a paid plan, they have first day free. This means you won't be charged for users who sign up and never return. So that's phenomenal. Every feature you need now and as you scale, get started at clerk.com. That's C-L-E-R-K.com. Once again, clerk.com.
Curious actually the connection between reactivity and resumability, because they both conceptually are mapping a dependency graph. Just one's about data and one's about code.
Yeah, actually, for a while, Wiz was attempting to, Wiz has been trying to improve DevEx for like 6 years now, probably longer, because one of the biggest challenges with resumability is you have to like work with these very fiddly event handlers that are like declaratively specified as attributes in the HTML, but then they're also like in the code somewhere else. So one of our first attempts was to actually create like a React style programming model. So what that means is your data is represented as just regular variables. And anytime you want to update the UI, you just rerun the whole template. And then, you know, memoization is your best friend. And this approach kind of did work to improve the DevEx. But then we kind of keep running into these performance challenges. And with React, with Signal's reactivity, like actual real reactivity, where you're doing the tracking of the data dependencies, like you're making the graph, like you said, you're able to like tell more precisely like what is the data that the component depends on. And that makes it easier to like, you know, leave some information about those data dependencies. Because it's not just the events that you care about. Like if you haven't hydrated a component, but its data changes because you hydrated a different component, like the usual example is like the shopping cart or something, then you want to know that, because this data changed, I need to hydrate the shopping cart and I need to update it.
Yes. So you have intersecting dependency graphs.
Right. And so you need to know two things. You need to know what the data was, and then you need to know what is the chunk that you need to load in order to like quote unquote hydrate that thing. Hydration, I'm kind of using the word loosely here. Like it's not necessary that you need to attach event handlers to the shopping cart. You actually just need to load like the update path and update the shopping cart because the user like added something to it. And so I need to increment that number by one.
That's really granular.
Right.
That's incredibly granular.
Yeah. And that's kind of what Quake is trying to do, right? Like it has a different update path and the optimizer just splits everything up into like many, many small pieces.
Yeah. And this, I guess, sets also some constraints on how you can use data and how you can manipulate the DOM as well. You can't just do document that .query selector all and find a random element and update it when something happens. Or you can't just update a random data property that is not wrapped inside of a signal because the framework wouldn't know about this and wouldn't be able to properly hydrate the page or resume the page.
So will Angular users notice a difference in like restrictions that they're able to like opt in to resumability? Or what changes will Angular users see in the developer experience? This is what I'm calling for.
Yeah, great question. So It will be, I guess it will change over time, but at first we will not just change Angular and make it entirely resumable, because we're going to break all the developers out there. They'll have to rewrite their applications, and we definitely don't want this. So we're introducing certain primitives. We have deferable views right now. This is just sounds fancy. It is one keyword that and a block that you can wrap certain part of your template into, and it will lazily load it. So we're adding some extra semantics on top of this when you do server-side rendering. And we're reusing some of the primitives that Wiz uses in order to achieve this resumability called JS Action, which handles events at a top level. And from there, based on the identifier, can figure out which codes to load from where. So just by adding additional, let's say, abstractions and functionality over time, we'll be able to get you closer to resumability to where it makes sense also by providing you a good developer experience. We'll decide at a certain point if we would like to flip the switch and make this the default behavior or not. But I would say we're many years away from this, and we're currently going gradually on this path of adding resumability concepts on top of the framework.
So a question related to that, you know, and I do love the kind of opt-in migration path that Angular has landed on. I think it is, you know, we've talked about it before, but it sets a really good standard, and it makes sense given the audience of Angular being so much in the enterprise, people who can't just drop everything on a dime, where that backwards compatibility is super important. But is there like a critical, so something like resumability, it feels like, I'm wondering if there's like a critical mass you need to hit to before you start to see the benefits, or do you see it immediately just on whatever component you have opted in for it on?
Yeah. So in Angular, later this year, we're going to introduce partial hydration, which is bringing us one step closer. And you'd immediately see the benefits there, because you'd already be loading half of your application, let's say. Or actually, at first, you would not be loading any JavaScript. You'd be only loading this small library JS action that is couple of kilobytes, and from there you'd cut, let's say, by half the JavaScript that you need for the page, depending on how you structure your component tree. So yeah, getting immediate benefits there, and at a certain point, as you can imagine, we might be able to get 80% of the benefits with 20% of the effort. So we'll decide from there whether it's worth really like optimizing for the remaining 20%, or we can just enable these remaining 20% for some applications that really need this high performance and keep Angular simpler for everyone else.
So that does put Angular, though, in the opposite perspective of like the Wiz or Qt mindset of fast by default, right? Because I think the idea, if I understood it, was developers are not going to keep up with this stuff. They're focused on shipping whatever they're focused on shipping. It's going to be slow. And Qt and Wiz say, you know what, we'll take care of that for you. We'll break everything apart. We'll go very fine-grained, and it will work fast by default. So where is that? How can you absorb that into Angular while maintaining the stability that you have?
Yeah, this is the beginning of the journey, what I'm talking about right now. And fast by default also comes with certain constraints and implications on developer experience that we are not 100% sure that are worth it at this point. So that's why the Wiz and the Angular team are working together in order to figure out what is kind of the optimal solution in there, how we can get the best from developer experience and performance and still achieve incredible performance for like 80% of the use cases and provide a path forward for the people who really are seeking the same performance as Google Search, let's say, to do the extra steps and get there.
So fast by default, is that what you're calling it internally? The term for like the general principle, the thought leadership behind how Wiz is built. Did that make sense? It didn't make sense. Neither of you are answering immediately.
We don't quite say that, but one of the key focus areas for Angular this year is actually fast from the start. And so that kind of is trying to capture like, you know, SSR is important. We're going to focus on SSR. But at the same time, after SSR, if you just do a hydration, that's going to like kill your performance. And so you need to also work on partial hydration. We need to start thinking about streaming, like SSR streaming, and so on.
So those are your priorities right now, is SSR streaming, and then eventually resumability.
Cool. Yeah, I have one, maybe a little bit of a hot take also. I would say that performance, it still needs to be a priority, even if you get like very highly optimized framework that is focused on performance, you can still make your application slow.
I'm very good at that.
Yeah, developers might needs to try a little harder to make their application slow, but we just see in HTTP Archive, the more adoption certain frameworks get, the slower the applications get over time as well. So it's unfortunate, but still I'm very confident that we're on the right path to overall make the web faster.
It's really easy to make your application slow. Just throw an LLM in there. That's what we're all doing these days, right?
Chatbots. You said HTTP Archive. Can you describe the relationship between how you talk to me, HTTP Archive? Where does that sit in your research pipeline?
Yeah, HTTP Archive, open data set, which has the top, I don't know, many thousands of like websites out there. And there is a crawling that happens, I think, about once a month. They measure the performance of each one of these targets and also what technologies are they using on the page. And we are definitely we are using it in many different ways. We're first curious to see what are the top performance challenges that websites are facing and figure out on what we should be focused on. There is another team at Google called Aurora. Aurora also joined us for our session at DevWorld, Hussein from Aurora. They're consistent. They're constantly looking at the HTTP Archive and try to figure out different patterns and how they can optimize the web overall, all different frameworks. So that's one way. Another way is on Angular, we're overall trying to like measuring the impact of the performance improvements that we're making by looking at HTTP Archive very often. It's not very like HTTP Archive is good for certain things, for example, measuring performance, but it also is biased towards specifically landing pages and which doesn't necessarily represent the whole framework community too well. A lot of frameworks are being used for dashboards, let's say, and they will not be present in there. So specifically for load time performance, this is where HTTP Archive comes really handy.
Well, and logged out pages too, right? Even if it's not just landing pages, you're not getting somebody's private dashboard in there.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes sense. So Jatin, for YouTube and stuff like that, the performance metrics aren't as great. Like HTTP Archive isn't as helpful for you.
Yeah. So since, you know, Wiz is also a very proprietary and internal framework, we have access to like the same product analytics and experimentation information and data that the product teams have access to. And yeah, and Google has a pretty sophisticated like experimentation framework. So we're able to like, you know, make a change, have a control group and compare that. And even if you do it for like 1% of all users, that's millions of users. And so we get pretty good data by doing those kinds of experiments.
So do you regularly do performance-only optimization experiments? Like, do you set a feature flag and you're like, did changing JS action in this way give us performance gains?
Yes, we're always doing stuff like that. And sometimes it's like just trying to shave like a few kilobytes. Actually, that's probably a huge improvement off of the initial render path on like the search results page, for example. In fact, if there's something that can actually save us a few kilobytes, it's worth spending a year or 2 years trying to actually get that, make sure it works, and you know, ramp it up for everybody.
Man, y'all live in a very different world.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense, right? The scale that you're talking about at Google, both in terms of access to data, but then like if you save a few kilobytes on YouTube, how many petabytes is that per week, right?
Yeah, like YouTube, and so the biggest thing that we're probably learning over the last 2 years is like how different these two products are. They're almost at like the two ends of a diameter, which represents like all possible. Like on one hand, you have a product that just wants to get the user off as soon as possible, right? Like show your search result, you find the result, you're gone, right? And on the other end, you come there, you kind of sit in, you kick your legs up and, you know, spend an hour watching YouTube or more. Completely different products that care about completely different things. So the 1 or 2 kilobytes example I gave was for search, right? Like, because it matters if instead of taking like 200 milliseconds, you can get it done in like 150, that's a really big deal. But for YouTube, that matters a little less. That doesn't mean you just load as much JavaScript as you want, but at the same time, other things are important, like contention. Like if you load a lot of JavaScript and now the browser is like spending time like dealing with that, it's not spending time initializing the video player and like running the video. So it still matters, but for different reasons.
I kind of love that direction, actually. So if somebody is building a new application, what would you sort of drive? And we'll frame it within Wiz and Angular land, maybe, but I think this is applicable to anyone choosing an application or framework. And most of us don't have the luxury of being able to choose Wiz, unless y'all are going to open source it. Silence. Okay.
Well, I guess in the long run.
True Angular, yeah.
We're open sourcing. Yeah.
How long?
Well, depends what the target is, but overall, everything will be happening gradually over the next years. Yeah.
So here's how to think about it, right? Like, we aren't trying to just converge by like explaining concepts to each other and then recreating those concepts. Like, that would be possible, and that would actually be great as well, but you'd still have two copies, right? We're converging by actually sharing code. So when we say YouTube is using signals, we literally mean the signals code that's in the Angular repository is running on YouTube.com and the mobile website and so on. When we say Angular is using JS Action, eventually that would mean that it's the same library, the same event dispatch library that's running on Google.com. And we're not maintaining two copies of the code. And so when you take that kind of approach to convergence, it's very real, and you have to do it slowly. Because every step of the way, you're kind of touching code that's in production. And it's hard to move that stuff.
And so you're putting each change of pulling Angular in behind a feature flag, basically internally, slowly, 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 checking those metrics, seeing if you're shaving, 50 milliseconds off on load time or not.
And also at the same time, trying to make this happen without breaking anyone. It's not trivial. It's how we want it to be at the same time. We want everyone to be able to take advantage of these features gradually, incrementally, and as opt-in at first.
What's up, friends and party people? I'm here with my good friend over at Speakeasy, founding engineer George Hadar. Speakeasy is the complete platform for great API developer experience. They help you produce SDKs, Terraform providers, docs, and more. George, take me on a journey through this process. Help me understand exactly what it takes to generate an SDK for an API at the quality level required for good user experience, good dev experience.
The reality is the larger your API becomes, the more you want to support users that want to use your API. And to do that, your instinct will be to ship a library, a package, and what we've been calling an SDK. There's a lot of effort involved in taking an API that lives in the world and creating a piece of software that can talk to that API. Building SDKs by hand is a significant investment, and a lot of large companies might pour a lot of money into that effort to create something that's like approaches good developer experience. And then another group of a more growing group of companies will rely on tooling like code generators. And so they're very interested in, like, once you make the decision to use a code generator, you're kind of forfeiting some of your own opinions and what you think a good developer experience is, because you're going to delegate that to a code generator to give you an SDK that you think users will enjoy using.
So there's various open source tooling out there that can do a version of what you do. How much research have you all put into doing it at a quality level that is enterprise API ready?
A lot of the customers that we've spoken to didn't have that experience. So they went to code generators, they tried to point them at their APIs and tell them, give me an SDK, and the outcome wasn't great. Like, it didn't support some of the features in OpenAPI, or the code that it was generating was not idiomatic TypeScript. We didn't boldly think we're gonna solve this better than everyone else. The reality is that that's where we came in. We surveyed all the things that have happened in JavaScript over the last few years, all the incredible projects like Xod, for example, and the web platform APIs that are now like broadly supported, like the Fetch API, the Web Streams API. We kind of saw this and said, there's a great opportunity to mix all these together and create the best experience you can get out of a code generator for users.
Okay, so paint a picture. What's a good next step? What can people expect when they go to speakeasyapi.dev?
If you're coming across Speakeasy today and you want to use it, you will go through the onboarding flow. And at some point, you're going to give us an open API document. That's your description of your API. And we're going to take that document and turn it into an SDK of your choice. You're going to get to pick which language is your first language. That's the one you'll get for free. And at that point, you can publish that package for the world to use. That's going to be yours. You get to license that however you want and then carry on from there. The way you iterate now is you keep changing your open API document. So as you develop your backend, you're going to produce alongside that the open API document with any updates over time and evolve that. And as you're evolving that, we're generating the SDKs and publishing them for you. And that also includes rich documentation that goes with them. So we're asking you to put a lot of effort just into describing your API, and we're going to do a lot of the heavy lifting that follows from that.
Okay, so as George mentioned, go to speakeasyapi.dev. You get your first SDK for free. So cool. Once again, speakeasyapi.dev.
So coming back real quickly to Jatin's point about, you know, optimizing for very different things. If someone's making a decision, is the view that no matter what you're optimizing for, eventually Angular plus Wiz, whatever this merge thing, Wizular, is going to, you know, that will be your solution, and it's maybe configuration that changes what you're optimizing for? Or is there still going to be some set of decisions about what's the right framework for the problem?
I think we will end up, if Wiz and Angular converge, so it's Wing, by the way, it's W-I-N-G.
I like Wizular better, but okay, Wing.
No, I like Wing. Wing is nice, it's short, NG's still capitalized the same way.
That's true, okay.
So I think it'll have the capabilities of handling, like, you know, all kinds of applications, but ultimately, if you don't kind of understand your business well, you can always use it in a wrong way, and then you feel like the framework's letting you down. So there's not going to be any framework that's going to somehow save you from having to like deeply understand the business need first. Like, what is the kind of page you're building? And then if you change your mind about what is the kind of page you're building, it's going to impact you. And so you have to like be very intentional about the different parts of your site and try to understand like, oh, this is a page where most of my users are just going to come in, check some status and leave. So it should be SSR, it should be really fast. And this is a page where like users are going to come in and like, you know, pour over the data for like many minutes or half an hour. And there's like a lot of complex UI here. And so you need a different kind of approach to building that. We'll certainly have a framework that'll let you make that kind of choice, but you could still get it wrong. And the framework's not a silver bullet.
Yeah. Great point here. Yeah. I'm also thinking it's not obvious always whether you need SSR all the time or CSR. They set different hosting requirements as well. And I know there has been from like push for SSR in certain communities, but also your monthly bill will be higher this way and you may not need it all the time. So that's one of the things where we're thinking SSR would be probably the default that we move forward with, but there is going to be a way for you to opt out of it if you just need static. If you want to just have static hosting.
That's super important to mention. I know the dashboard crowd is pro CSR in general. So question, I kind of wanted to go deeper, Cable, into thinking critically about your performance. Can you talk a little bit, Jatin or Minko, about Lighthouse and the nice green 100 bubble and when you should or shouldn't care about that, depending on what you're optimizing for?
I'll say just the business, whatever the business cares about. It's a dashboard. 100 out of 100 might not be the most important thing, especially if you're accessing over Ethernet. Like if you're building an e-commerce platform or e-commerce like website, I'll say that 100 out of 100 is probably critical. But there are also other bubbles on there, on Lighthouse, around accessibility that are also just equally important in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I think you have to look at your business metrics as well. And like just focusing on like one particular metric will probably be a bad idea if you do it for the long term.
I'm curious if you can sort of sketch out the space here. So we've talked about kind of two ends of the spectrum, right? Somebody who's coming in and making a snap decision, whether it's e-commerce or they're coming to search, they want something as quick as possible and bouncing off. And we've talked about kind of the very long, you're either sitting and watching a video on YouTube or you're really exploring a bunch of stuff in a dashboard where, you know, that initial load time might not be that important because you're going to spend 45 minutes or an hour there. And that's like, seems like two ends of one dimension. Are there other dimensions that you think about or that you would recommend application developers thinking about?
I think Minko brought up a really good one with accessibility. I think you have to think about the kinds of users you want to reach out to. And so that really is something you have to like consciously like be aware of, in addition to like time people are spending. Anything else?
Yeah, security. Security, I'll say, is another one. I'll say they're both accessibility and security are probably things that you would like to optimize for all the time. And we've been having a little on the internet, like when I open Twitter, I just see people focus on the performance bubble in Lighthouse, which is fun, but also like accessibility would not make your application usable by like a lot of people, which might be even more critical than performance. But yeah, performance is definitely another important topic. It is also critical for a lot of people without stable network access, also not being able to make your application accessible for them. Yeah, I can't think of anything else that actually that like any other kind of spectrums or like any other like dimensions that we're...
You almost alluded to one there about in network stability, right? There's ability to function in some form or another without internet, you know, the whole like local first or something in that domain where maybe you can load it asynchronously with this inconsistent network, but then once you've got it loaded, you're able to interact there.
Yeah, good point. Jared is working with the Workspace team very often. And I was surprised by how well their product worked actually when we traveled for DevWorld. I didn't have network access and made some last minute changes on our deck and everything ended up working out. Magical.
That actually reminds me of maybe another spectrum, and that spectrum is like consistency. So what I mean by that is if you're making a product like a spreadsheet and there's a lot of like, you know, complex formulas and ways to calculate things, you're likely reaching out to your users on multiple platforms. And so you want the stuff to work the same way on Android and iOS and web. And so you kind of have to make that decision of like, what do you want the same code running everywhere? Or do you like want to target one of those platforms and then like the others can like catch up like in your business, right? And so Workspace actually does run the same code everywhere. So there's a lot of like technology choices there. But then like imagine like writing your web code using like Kotlin or something like that, or, you know, any one of these like cross-platform tools. So that's kind of important. Dimension as well. You make that choice like, oh, I'm going to be platform native everywhere, so I'm just going to make my app n times, or I'm not doing that, I'm making my app once. And I think Jess is pretty familiar with this area.
Yeah, I work at Ionic. We do cross-platform. Write once, run anywhere. Oh gosh, I can't believe I said that. I'm sorry to everybody listening. John, is that public? Did I miss that?
The what?
Google's code sharing between like JavaScript and Kotlin and Swift, like, is that public, that compiler?
No, I give an example that Kotlin was an example, but the actual code sharing we do inside is very complex and a lot of it is proprietary, like the tech is not open source, but Kotlin is one of the open source tools we do have at Google. The other one being Dart, right? Flutter lets you write everywhere. So this is Google. We have a couple of options for everything, right?
This is Google.
Yes.
I think that's a meme. Isn't that a meme? This is Google. I don't know if that's a public meme.
I think on the positive and the negative, right? Like there's so many, like the tech geek in me would absolutely love to work inside of Google. And then I also know so many people working there and the dysfunction sometimes is also there. So I don't know. So we've talked a little bit about the timeline for this. It's kind of a long timeline, not super well-defined. You're exploring things. If people want to get involved in this and they are not inside of Google, is there a route for them to do so?
Yeah, we're posting regular updates, and also a lot of pull requests are landing. I mean, not a lot, but there are a couple of pull requests, maybe a year, that will be landing with the primitives inside of that we're sharing across both frameworks. So that's one way. There might be more ways later this year, but yeah, that's what we have for now.
Okay, so essentially get involved with Angular to see the inside scoop of what's coming in from Wiz.
Yeah, and contributing to some of these primitive packages, they're inside of like literally primitives directory in the Angular repository. Your code could be running, if you make a contribution there, your code might be running on youtube.com by the end of the day.
Ooh.
End of the day.
Yeah. And it depends on the time. But yeah, we try to do like daily releases in a lot of our large apps as well. And yeah, it's certainly possible. Like anything that ends up in primitives is actually going to be running in production in Google as well. And so that's like a great way to try to, you know, it's understand like what is one way to do this and also know that any changes you make there are impacting a lot of users.
If somebody doesn't feel comfortable contributing publicly on GitHub at that point, like they're not there yet in their open source journey, will there be a set of best practices that you publish for Angular developers? Soon to be wing developers, eventually wing developers.
Yeah, overall, contributing to that specifically contributing to the Angular community, I guess, like in broader sense, there could be like many different ways. Like my very first pull request to Angular was just adding one missing brace in the documentation. And it took me 5 hours to open this pull request because I was thinking, how could these people from Google make a mistake? I was so nervous. It took me literally many hours, and that's documentation is a great example, or just writing, like looking at the code and writing a blog post about it, or learning community inside of your company, just talking to your colleagues about these shared primitives and how you can use them in your framework of choice even. All of this is just different alternatives for how people can get involved.
Awesome. Well, I think with that, we're probably at a good place to wrap this up. Any last words, Minko or Jatin, that you want to share about Angular, Wiz, and the wing future?
Yeah, so this is like super exciting for all of us. And, you know, we're really looking forward to continuing to share more primitives this way. And, you know, very excited to get feedback from the community. We want to be just generally helpful to all web developers out there, right? Like we are trying to like now have these discussions about getting signals into JavaScript itself, and see whether, you know, it's something that makes sense for all frameworks. And so yeah, come talk to us, engage with Angular, and looking forward to it.
Yeah, we'll be posting more updates in May with version 18, and after that we'll be slowly rolling out partial hydration. So pick some upcoming updates.
All right. Jess, any last thoughts?
You mentioned the signals repo. I got excited. We can't go into it. We don't have time, but I hope that we get to talk about it on the show sometime soon.
Is there a public signals repo?
There, it just released. Jatin, Minko, both of you have been involved in it, if I understand correctly.
All right. Well, let's at least put that in the show notes for people who want to follow up, and maybe we can do a future deep dive. All right. Well, with that, I think we have just about run this into the ground. Minko, Jatin, thank you for joining us today. Jess, lovely to have a show with you as an official JS Party panelist. And with that, that is JS Party. I'm K-Ball, signing out. Take care. See you all next week.
Is JS Party for this week. Thanks for hanging with us. We would love to get more awesome reviews for the pod into Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So for a limited time only, you leave us a thoughtful 5-star review, send the evidence to jsparty@changelog.com, and we'll send you a free pack of Changelog stickers right to your door. Let's do this. Thanks once again to our partners at Fly.io, to our Beat Freak in Residence, Breakmaster Cylinder, and to our friends at Sentry. We love Sentry and have been using it for years. If and when it's time for you to check it out, use code CHANGELOG. That helps us because Sentry knows we're making an impact on their business, and it helps you because they'll give you $100 off the team plan. Once again, use code CHANGELOG, all one word. That's all for now, but come on back and party with us again next week.